We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson, Jason Croft is at the controls this hour, and Kyle Mabry was on hour number one. By the year 2030, there will be more than 70 million Americans beyond the traditional retirement age. So clearly, one thing we know is that we are all living longer. But the question that we'll try to take up this morning is, are we living better? Is it possible that we might live better and longer? Are some of the promises being made promises that will be difficult, if not impossible, to fulfill? Our guest in this hour of the show is a science writer, Susan Jacoby. She is author of the new book, which is entitled Never Say Die, The Myth and Marketing of the New Old Age. She takes on the idea that old age is something that can be defied, that baby boomers can look forward to a radically new old age free of health problems, financial difficulties, and problems like loneliness. She says it's important for those people who are about to turn 65 to understand the difference between marketing hype and a realistic hope for what lies ahead. The book is recently published. It's published by Pantheon, so if you'd like to head out to the bookstore and look at it, you certainly may. Our guest, Susan Jacoby, is the author of 9 books, most recently The Age of American Unreason. She also writes for various publications and does a lot of speaking and makes her home in New York City, and she's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are certainly welcome as we talk with Susan Jacoby. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. You may also send us an email if you like, and that is will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, you can give us a call. And Ms. Jacoby, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Right. My mother went to the University of Illinois. I always like to talk to the NPR station in Champaign-Urbana.
Really? So what did she study here?
Apparently partying. This is a long time ago.
That is still a popular major.
She regrets that.
That is still a popular major. Well, I appreciate very much you spending some time with us. And I think just as a way of starting, I'm really struck by one of the stories that you tell about how maybe you got interested in and thinking about this and writing about this because you are a science writer and you had attended...
Excuse me, I'm not a science writer. I do write about science, but I'm more of a cultural historian. I'm interested in how science interacts with American values and history, but I'm not a science writer.
Oh, all right. Better and clearer. So as someone who occasionally writes about science, who pays attention to science, know that you had attended this conference, and there was this panel. And the name of the panel was 90 is the New 50. And you went and attended this. And apparently there were people, most of the people on the panel were actually really serious about this when they were talking about 90 being the new 50.
Yes, well, actually, that's right. When I saw the title 90 is the New 50, which could hardly be a more unscientific title, I thought, let me go and see if anyone really believes this. And the room, it was standing room only. The people were, I would say, mainly in their 40s and 50s and early 60s, younger to the older boomers. And the atmosphere was very much like that of an old time revival meeting. Really, there was a voice of reason on the panel, but most of it was basically about how not someday, but in our lifetime, there's going to be a pill we can take with our antioxidant juice in the morning, which will make 90 the new 50, and which will also, in some way, target the worst killers and the most feared killers of old age, such as Alzheimer's. Mm.
Well, that's, you know, just it's something that's come up on the program a couple of times recently, not very long ago. I interviewed someone who really truly is a science writer who has just now written a book about the science and the scientists who are looking at the problem of age and asking that question, what is the upper limit and how much can the upper limit be pushed? And he seemed to be saying that there are scientists who consider themselves and consider to be serious scientists who do believe that it is possible, not next week, but it is possible at some point, if we truly understand the mechanisms of aging and we get to understand better things like Alzheimer's disease and cancer, there are people who do actually believe that humans could live to, I don't know, pick your number, 200 or even
longer. What a delightful prospect.
Well, that's also, I think, to be fair to the book, one of the questions that he also deals with is, even if you could do that, would you want to?
Yes. First of all, there are scientists who really do believe it's possible really not to live as long as 200, but that the upper limits of age, which are really now around 100, mm-hmm. could be extended 20 or 30 years if we find a way to target and reverse or slow down anti-aging genes. There's another group of serious scientists who say we've got to look for specific diseases. Now, I suspect that what is going to happen down the road is, I think that this anti-aging science eventually will have something to contribute to the very specific diseases like Alzheimer's. There is a big quarrel in the scientific community between whether aging itself is a disease and aging is the disease that causes all other diseases, because the fact is as we age, all of the mechanisms of our body become less efficient, and as we move into old age in our 80s and 90s, in which half of all people have dementia, which is a startling statistic, that aging is a mechanism that interacts with both genetics and environment is undoubted. That we are going to be able to reverse aging in the lifetime of the baby boomers, this is quite apart from the question of whether that's even a good idea. That's a very esoteric thought.
But so you're saying that, yeah, in fact, it's, you know, some of these things we're talking about might be possible,
right.
But we're talking about maybe a couple of generations hence, not anytime soon.
Well, that's what most of the scientists I talk to say, that even these are people who, my dear friend Robert Butler, who was the only voice of reason on the 90 is the new 50 panel, he practically invented the field of gerontology. He was the first director of the National Institute on Aging in the 1970s. And he died last year of leukemia at the age of 82. And I asked him, I interviewed him for the book after this panel, and I said, what do you think of this idea, which would be so nice, that a cure for Alzheimer's is just around the corner? And I'll quote him. He said, I'm a scientist and no one believes in science more than I do. And I'd love to wake up tomorrow morning and see that there's a cure for Alzheimer's in the paper. But he said, realistically, the more scientists discover about this disease, the more we learn about it, the more we learn how genetically complicated it really is. And he said, realistically, we can hope for a cure, but hope isn't a plan of action for old age as it is now. And I think that's the way to look at it, which is this cure. I'm sure that there will, of course, someday be something to at least delay or treat Alzheimer's in the way that there is now. For instance, diabetes is incurable, but it's treatable. That will happen, but it's a very complicated disease, and to count on it happening for us, people now in their 40s and 50s and early 60s, is really a dangerous delusion.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that you talk about is how it is that, let us say, between the time when we were children and now, we think very differently about who is old, what it means to be old, how one lives in old age, so that you would say, on the one hand, we maybe have made a little bit of progress on the subject of ageism, and yet it's really a lot more complicated than just that.
Well, I think there's a big difference. When I was growing up in the 1950s, there was really just a stereotype of the old as useless, hopelessly useless. As I say in my book, I mean, when I was growing up, if the image of parents having sex was kind of disgusting to kids. The image of grandparents having sex was absolutely unimaginable. And I think that changed a lot in the late 1960s when I was coming of age, partly because the people who were over 65 of that generation, they participated in the spirit of the times. Remember, one of the main anti-Vietnam War protest leaders was Dr. Benjamin Spock, who was born in 1903. So I think that the dissident spirit of the time, when a lot of grandparents marched for civil rights and against the Vietnam War, had an effect on the way my generation looked at old age. And, of course, people were really living longer. However, I think that we really have a new kind of ageism today, and that is, oh, it's great to be old as long as you're the exception, as long as you don't exhibit any of the typical problems of old age, which are the 80s and 90s, and that's what demographers and doctors call old age. So we all have this, we revere Betty White. She's on every talk show every other night. Because we would all like to be Betty White in old age, or Justice John Paul Stevens, who retired from the Supreme Court at age 90 and is now writing legal essays, publishing everywhere, that anybody would be thrilled to be able to write at any age because he's got a working brain. But to expect that this kind of old age is going to happen for everyone is just a fly in the face of reality. The reality is that for people who live into their 90s, and I'm the daughter and granddaughter of women in the family who've lived into their late 90s, death usually comes after a long period of mental, physical decline, or both. This fantasy of the sexy skydiving centenarian, in which we're all never going to be sick a day in our lives, and we're going to drop dead of a heart attack while making love or paragliding or something like that. This is a fantasy, and I think it's a dangerous fantasy because it prevents us from talking about what we can really do to make 90 a better 90 and 80 a better 80, even if it's not going to be the new 50.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Susan Jacoby. She's the author of the book Never Say Die, The Myth and Marketing of the New Old Age. Pantheon is the publisher, and it's just out recently. Questions are certainly welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. We hope people can be brief, but questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. It is interesting that as a combination of modern medical science and the fact that there are more people perhaps that are living a more healthy lifestyle, that we do have people who are in their 60s and maybe even in their 70s who are actually pretty healthy.
Of course.
But that we do seem there seems to be this line that gets crossed. You know, maybe once you get into your 80s, that says that statistically speaking, the incidence of debilitating problems are just going to go up and maybe fairly dramatically go up at a certain point, and we don't really know what to do about that.
Well, right now, there's nothing we can do about it. Statistically, I'm not sure, by the way. I think that there's been an exaggeration of what great health habits the boomers have, and this is very important. These great new health habits are mostly the province of a small upper middle class. And in fact, people who have not only absorbed what medicine has to say about how you keep yourself healthier at any age, exercise, diet, all of these things, but people who have always had good access to medical care. The gap between the rich and the poor in this society weighs even more heavily on the old, because not only have they had less access to health care their whole lives, they're in a lot worse shape when they get to their 60s and 70s. And there is a direct correlation between life expectancy and how much money you make in this country, which is something, it goes against the American egalitarian ethic. Yes, it's true. Statistically, it doesn't tell you what will happen with any individual, but statistically, everybody who lives into their 80s and 90s has a lot more health problems than people in their 60s and 70s. But there's also a big class difference and a big sex difference. Women are much poorer than men, and the longer they live, the poorer they get.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of elements that make up old age, and they're just not all health. And one of the things I say in my book is, One of the most actually depressing things during the writing of this book was the National Institutes of Health did a big review of every study about what might prevent Alzheimer's. There have been a lot of studies suggesting that maybe exercising or playing computer games could delay or prevent Alzheimer's. The NIH did a huge review of this, and the scientists who did the reviewing of all of these studies all over the world, they hoped to find that there was something people could do. But what they found was, at this point, there is no negligible, it's just a negligible effect, which isn't to say that it's not great to keep yourself as healthy as you can by doing all of these things, not smoking, not drinking to excess, exercise, but it's not a magic protector against these diseases that strike in old age.
I suppose, when it comes to Alzheimer's particularly, that's just a reflection of the fact that at this point we really don't have much of any idea what's going on and
We're learning more, and one of the things we know is that it's a process that begins to unfold silently years or even decades before people even have symptoms. This may ultimately help science find at least an ameliorative thing, which it doesn't have right now. And by the way, the NIH review also found that none of the prescription drugs or non-prescription supplements, peddled by the hucksters of longevity, have any real effect on the progression of this disease. And the scientists they didn't want this result. It's just the way it is right now.
Well, perhaps you can talk some more about how it is that we got to this point, going back to your earlier comment about how, well, when it comes to thinking about aging and talking about aging, we're at this point where we say, well, there's nothing wrong with getting old as long as you don't show any of the problems associated with getting old.
As long as you're not really old.
Yeah, that's where it makes it sound as if we're accepting of old age when, in fact, maybe we're not.
We're accepting of an old age that here's what successful aging is the concept, and we're accepting of an old age that looks successful, these people who are doing all of these things and seem younger than we used to think old was. The problem is that we're all capable of aging successfully until we aren't. My mother is 90. If you'd asked me 4 years ago, she was a prime example of successful aging. She worked as a volunteer at a very important job at a local hospital 25 hours a week. In the last 4 years, her body, not her mind, has simply fallen apart, and she is confined to her room in an assisted living facility. My grandmother also, who died at 99, was fine until she was about 95. Then again, her body fell apart, and she outlived her savings, and she ended her life in a nursing home. If you live long enough, unless you are one of these lucky few who just drop dead without ever being sick a day in your life, this is going to happen. We need to think of how to help people in these circumstances.
Is this, even though, again, as we keep talking about how we have changed our attitudes about aging, is this really a reflection of the fact that while we might say that, we actually haven't, and that the idea of youthfulness and wanting to continue to appear and behave in a youthful manner still conquers everything?
Absolutely not. You will notice I am using the word old. That is deliberate. Old is considered almost an obscenity in most of the media, which really shows us what our true attitudes toward old age are. The Today Show on the first Monday of 2011 opened up with the story about the oldest baby boomers turning 65. I listened to it very carefully. It was almost 10 minutes long, which is like dog years in television time. And they did not, one of the experts on the panel used the word old. The preferred euphemisms, there are two of them. One is older, and older than whom, I ask you. And the other is just aging. And aging is a particularly idiotic euphemism for old, because while we're all aging, we're not all old. My 21-year-old nieces are aging. They are not old. I am one of those people who has, in the last year, turned 65. Now, you can do the math yourself. If I were middle-aged, how many 130-year-olds are running around out there on the street?
That's kind of what I felt when I turned 50. Well, how much?
But old to me is just a neutral description of a stage in life. It doesn't imply that you're not healthy, that you're not capable of doing things until you reach a point in very advanced old age where people do begin to sustain losses.
Well, how much of this also has to do with the fact that there are a lot of people who are interested in selling products that are where they make claims about they will be able to forestall or halt the aging process?
I know. Age-defying cream. It's in front of every beauty product that's sold, and not only to the old, but to women over 30. It's very funny. Age-defying this, age-defying that, defying old age. Supplements, which again have been found to be scientifically worthless in the little clinical research that's been done on it. But people believe in them. Now, there's a huge amount of money to be made from selling the Fountain of Youth. There always has been. That's not unique to America. It's not unique to this century. It's not unique to the baby boom generation. But I think one of the things that's different now is that we baby boomers, you're in the younger baby boomer group, I'm in the older one. We baby boomers have grown up in an age of huge medical breakthroughs. My first medical memory is standing in line when I was 9 years old for the Salk polio vaccine. I'm old enough to remember when summer was a frightening experience, when parents kept their kids indoors in the summer because they were so scared of their getting polio. So we've had a lot of these things, and as time has gone on, we now have things like joint replacements, you know, which were science fiction when my parents were the age that I am. However, these are basically mechanical fixes. There is no comparison between the intricate genetic process of aging involving our biological clocks and finding a vaccine for polio. It was only a matter of finding the right formula. The process of immunization had been well known for 200 years. And in the same way that a joint replacement is only a mechanical solution, it doesn't mean that your body is not continuing to wear out. I mean, one of the things that some of the people who most focus on anti-aging do is that they envisage a world of better replacements in which we can use our own genetic DNA to replace our body parts. And while nobody believes that immortality is possible, certainly there are a lot of people who believe we can live a lot longer lives if we want to.
We have a couple of callers here. Let's talk with them, and we'll start with somebody in Champaign. Line number one. Hello.
Hello. Yeah. Yes. I was just thinking in your analysis of the way that old age is more accepted now, but only if people fit a certain profile. It seems that the profile you describe can actually be applied somewhat to any age, that society is more accepting of people as long as they are fit and healthy and good-looking, and that at any age, the kind of disabilities and sickness and inability to take care of yourself makes one less appealing to society. I mean, the whole healthcare debate that's been going on recently has made it clear that large segments of our society find people who can't take care of their health needs to be almost, less worthy of, almost the kind of epithets that were thrown at people that can't take care of their health needs financially at any age is really scary. And I wonder if some of that is not just an extension of that whole attitude.
That is a really good point. I think this caller is right on the mark. The difference with old age is that people are, because of the nature of what aging does to our bodies, people are, the number of people who can't take care of their own needs, the proportion of people who can't take care of their own needs in their 80s and 90s is much higher. But I think that he is absolutely right about this, that there is, and this is part of why the fact that there are going to be 8.5 million Americans over 85 just 20 years from now, There is. This is unique to America. You don't find it in the countries of Northern Europe that the right wing speaks about so contemptuously here. There is an idea that you must have done something wrong if things turn out so you need help. Just as there is, when former Senator Alan Simpson of Wyoming, the co-chair of the Federal Deficit Commission, he called Social Security a cow with 310 million tits. Well, I don't think that was an accident, by the way, since the majority of people over 85 are women. But the fact is we apply the same standards to people who can't save enough money to live on until their 90s. And I would submit to you that is actually most people. You know, when you look at saving, and Americans can be criticized for not saving enough, but sort of the median income for a family of four right now is about $60,000. You think about that, a family of four, you think about how many people can possibly save the percentage of their after-tax income to finance 30 years of life after they're able to work, or after there are many people, older people who are willing to work, who can't find jobs, just like young people. But the fact is that do we really want a society in which a 45-year-old parent says to their college-age kids, "Sorry, I can't help you out with college. I'm saving for my long-term care." Is that a good society in which resources are directed simply toward the old? No. This has got to – the care of the old, like the care of the young, it's got to be a shared social responsibility. And until this country realizes that, I mean, I think frankly, that my generation, people like me who are 65 now, never been healthier or more energetic in my life, but that's not necessarily going to be true 20 years from now when I look at the fate of my mother and grandmother. I think we have got to work out a solution. The boomers, while we're still a very strong, healthy voting bloc, with younger people, that takes into account both the needs of the dependent old and what young people need to live on. Younger people are not going to be so crazy about Medicare and Social Security deductions to pay for me at age 85 if they still have to spend 20% of their after-tax income on their own health care.
Something else, though, I think what the caller says is certainly right. His comment is certainly right. But I think that you also make the point that we're still that we're not very tolerant of – that we'd be more tolerant of certain things in a younger person than we would in an older, in the sense that, well, say, for example, you have somebody who's 30 years old and their partner has died and they're dealing with depression. Somehow we're much more understanding about that than somebody who is 80 and isn't having depression because their partner died. We seem to want to say to that person, well, you just deal with it because that's all part of getting old, whereas we would never say that to somebody who was 30.
Well, actually, I take your point, and you're right in general, but actually, one of the things I drew from the caller is actually this society doesn't have a lot of tolerance for people who grieve too long. Big pharma will come for you at any age if you don't at least appear to have gotten over a loss in a fairly short order. Why, there was an op-ed piece in the New York Times about 2 weeks ago by a researcher who had found that people generally get over the loss of a life partner, well, a lot better than is thought. And if people are still grieving deeply after 6 months, maybe they really need some help. I think that this is just utter nonsense, that there is some timetable, some normal timetable, and it's abnormal if you've lost your partner of 30 years to be grieving more than 6 months later, or at least to be grieving in a way that you're conscious of in your everyday life. And, you know, big pharma and the more authoritarian members of the helping professions can come for you and help you get rid of it. That's just nonsense. But I do think that when old people, I think you're right to this extent, when old people display typical reactions to loss, it's thought of as part of being old rather than just a reaction to loss, which anybody would have at any age.
We are a little bit past our midpoint here. Again, our guest is Susan Jacoby, and her book is Never Say Die, The Myth and Marketing of the New Old Age. Pantheon is the publisher. It is recently out, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And you may also send your thoughts along by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have another caller, and this is someone in Kankakee. And it's line four. Hello.
Yeah, David. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Great program. Very interesting. Got a perspective, a couple of perspectives, and then I'll go ahead and ring off. Your guest is great. There was a piece on the news just this weekend. This woman was 64 years old, and this was talking about life savings. And it was to the point. They were serious, but it was really to the point almost being ridiculous. She had $125,000 in savings, and this financial expert goes, "Well, you know, Miss Jones, you're going to need four times that. People don't realize you need four times that." And I'm thinking, how many people, 64 years old, have $600,000 in savings just for themselves? I mean, it's beyond ridiculous.
Fewer than 1% is the answer.
Yeah, how much?
Fewer than 1%.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, nowadays the dynamic has changed. Most people are just, if they have a job, they're happy to keep it or just to find food. But so I think we need to rethink that. But my my other point was, I worked for a company that serviced nursing homes. And I can tell you, I've been in most of the nursing homes in Illinois. And to a certain point, it would be great to live a long life, but I think we have to think about quality of life issues, because I've seen so many homes where really these people could be very vital, but they're basically being warehoused. And it's a tragic and sad state of affairs in this country as far as how detached we are from older people. In other words, they're not really part of our extended family. They get to be a certain age, and we kind of put them on the shelf. And I think longevity would be wonderful, but I think we have to think about running out of resources, and also, if we do get old, what is the quality of life that we're looking at? And I'll go ahead and ring off. Thanks.
Well, there are things that can be done, but they require almost talking about them in the current political climate almost seems hopeless. The budget cutting mania, for instance. First of all, there are people in nursing homes who don't belong there and wouldn't have to be there. If, for example, my grandmother might have been able to live independently until she died, had there just been some government, you know, public subsidy for, say, a visiting nurse once a day, someone to help her with some of to bathe and things like that. She was in a terrible situation in a nursing home, because most people in nursing homes are there because of dementia. And unless there is a family to take care of a demented person, there is no way in the last stages of Alzheimer's that people cannot really be in nursing homes, unless there is a devoted partner or son or daughter to take care of them. But there is almost no subsidy for at-home services that could keep people with healthy minds but bodies with some troubles, like my grandmother, out of nursing homes, and it would be much less expensive also than putting these people in nursing homes. We don't think about that at all. We don't think about the kinds of, for instance, families who are willing to take care of people with Alzheimer's. If there were more community centers where the families could get a break, you know, where people could go for care during the day or during the night. There are so few of these things. All of these things for the care of the most dependent elderly, they are routine throughout Europe, and they are almost unobtainable here.
And this is, I think this gets at, if people haven't gotten the idea, this gets at, I think, one of the most important points that you're trying to make, is that one of the consequences of this attitude that we have about aging, this idea that it's something that can be defied and defeated, and are not wanting to acknowledge the fact that we do have people in their late 80s and 90s who do have serious health issues, and although could live successfully with some assistance, what it is we're doing is we're really not dealing with the kinds of problems and how it is we might respond to them,
right,
of that particular group.
If 90 really yeah. were the new 50,
yeah.
it wouldn't be a problem. You and I could work and shop till we drop.
But we're not going to, chances are. That's the problem. And so that's why it gets the idea of home health care, or the idea of really dealing with how it is we deliver medical care to people who are older, or how
and
it is,
and
you know.
Let's move it away for a minute. I mean, we're only talking about health and illness,
mm-hmm.
but there are lots of other issues involving old age which are equally important. I mean, for example, there are, as I say in my book, I don't believe in the so-called wisdom of old age is anything automatic, which is to say, I think if you're wise and you can learn from your experience at 40 and 50, then if you've got your mind, you'll continue to do so at 80 and 90. And if you're a fool who never admits to a mistake at 40 or 50, you will be that same kind of person, only more so later on. That said, there are a lot of older people who can't work full-time, but who have a lot to contribute in a lot of areas of our society, from education to health care to all kinds of things. But we have very few opportunities for old people who want to contribute. Our society isn't structured that way. I have so many friends in their 50s who've lost their jobs and can't find another one because nobody's offering jobs to people in their 50s who've lost out in this economy. And so another thing is that there are a lot of resources of old people who are wise and who are smart and who do have intellectual vigor, and we don't have a society set up. These are people who my mom worked 25 hours a week as a volunteer until four years ago. You know, what if there were some pay attached to that? Well, of course, one of the reasons the hospitals like it is they don't have to pay the volunteers. But what I'm saying is that we don't put our money where our mouth is. You know, we talk about the new old age and all that, but in fact, we give old people almost no opportunity. Those who can bring to bear their experience and their smarts, we give them almost no opportunity to do it.
Yeah, we have another caller. I think line number one. Is there a caller there? Hello. Oh, perhaps not. Well, in any case, other calls are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. I do have an email. I don't know how you might respond to it, but someone listening here says, have you noticed that age denial also extends to people's pets? The person here writes, we kept an old golden retriever suffering from cancer alive longer than I think previous generations would. He was a therapy dog and so popular with the hospital patients that we couldn't let him go, especially since we saw that visiting others cheered him up so much.
The answer is yes. the answer is yes. And unlike people who can communicate, pets can't communicate. So really, whatever we do with our pets is a reflection of ourselves, because no matter how much we love our pets, they can't tell us, do they want to have chemotherapy? You know, I mean, it's in a way so that anything that people do, and people do now spend a lot of money keeping pets alive who have things like cancer, brain tumors, we don't know what our pets want. And by the way, this is one of the reasons why for people, it is so important and so bad. There are a few things we can do individually right now if the odds are that we're going to get some kind of a terrible disease at the end of life. But one of them is we can make a living will. We can appoint someone legally to carry out our wishes about end-of-life care. And for all the talk there's been about this, only 30% of Americans have made living wills, and even fewer have legally appointed someone to act for them. And this is something we can do. If you don't want to, for instance, be hooked up to machines in a hospital for a month at the end of life, you can stop that. If you only will allow yourself to think about this possibility, and the best time to do it is while you're young and healthy. Mm. One of the worst things that happened the last couple of months was that Obama bowed to the right wing and withdrew this proposal just for voluntary consultations with doctors for healthy patients who want to talk about end-of-life care, which, by the way, is a conversation doctors need as much as patients, because doctors are every bit as scared and unrealistic about old age and death as anybody else is.
Yeah, this was the whole death panel business.
Yes.
And I know that you have some strong feelings about it, and this was something that the idea was that, you know, the doctors, it was an idea that said, okay, we'll compensate doctors for the time that they spend in that conversation. It's not that we're forcing anybody to have the conversation, but that we're encouraging people to say, when you're of sound mind and you're healthy and you have time to think about
it,
just think about what you want and then say what you want. And it's not saying we're not telling people what they should want, just saying, okay, you figure out what you want and go on record.
No, and by the way, one of the big mistakes the media have done is they've presented this as that there's some kind of religious objection to not doing everything when there's no hope of recovery. This is only a far-right fringe. Most mainstream religions do not require anyone to take unusual means. In other words, they don't require you to be hooked up to a respirator or to take artificial foods or anything like that if there's no hope of recovery. So this is just and this is one of the few things that individuals can do for themselves. And I can tell you, my mom was a volunteer in the critical care unit of a very large hospital in the Michigan city where she lives. And she saw the results of people not having done this. She saw families throwing coffee cups at each other in the critical care waiting room because the children disagreed about what to do about mom. Should they pull the plug? Well, my brother and I know exactly what our mother wants us to do. She spelled it out 30 years ago when she was as healthy as could be, and her mind hasn't changed about this since then.
Some other callers here. Champagne, next, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I guess I have the advantage of having seen retirement home situations for more than 50 years now, and I can trace the contrast between when my grandmother went into a retirement home up in the western suburbs of Chicago in the 50s. She had her own room. It was a private room with a sink and a toilet bathroom in it. The other bath with the shower and tub was down the hall. She and her fellow residents ate in family-style meals in the dining room, and it was a great place for its day. Now, 50 years later, my mother is in a retirement home, also up in the western suburbs, and people in the independent living apartments there can have one, two, or three-bedroom units. Why you would need three, I'm not quite sure. They are provided with dinner, but they still have kitchens with trash compactors and granite counters in the newly upgraded rooms. And I look at how much this costs, and I look at who they're marketing to, and they're mostly marketing to the baby boomer children of the people that would be likely to move in. And, of course, some of those people up in that area can afford that or aspire to.
Very expensive, yes.
But I just don't view this not only as economically sustainable, as one of the previous callers said. You know, people don't have – I mean, even if you had your whole amount of money that you have coming in every year, it would be well over $50,000 to live there for one person.
Absolutely.
But also just environmentally, I don't know why people need all that, but it seems like the whole society has gotten more toward an aspirational view of things where people that don't really cook, why do they need a trash compactor? If there's one person or two, why do they need three bedrooms? And I just, the nursing home and retirement home business is growing like gangbusters. I don't know how that can be sustained, but it has been so far. Also, a whole other subject is who are going to be the aides to take care of these people as they get into assisted living in nursing homes. And
well, first of all,
so those are just, I'll hang up and listen.
Yeah, well, thank you for the call.
You're talking about something that is available only to a few, first of all. This kind of retirement community is only available to people who have a lot of money. One of the things that might be a lot more effective and better for people is one thing that happens to a lot of older people of limited means, not the poor, but the just sort of people who are just getting by, is they're priced out. If they rent apartments, they're priced out of the apartments that they've lived in for a long time by rising rent. Some rent supplements could keep people in those apartments at much less of a cost than having to move to a public facility. But I don't think what she's talking about is sustainable only for the rich. It is not going to be there. It's not going to be there for the baby boomers, who in some ways are going to enter retirement at a greater disadvantage than their parents. One of the things, everybody talks about the losses in the crash of 2008. But here's something interesting. Even before the crash, the average individual retirement account, the 401k, was only $45,000. This is, in other words, it's so far below what's needed for retirement. And furthermore, only half of Americans ever had them in the first place because most companies don't contribute to them and lots of people don't make enough money to contribute to them. I think the idea that there is just a personal solution to this, it's very American, but we're going to find out differently when this cannonball comes at us 20 years from now.
Another caller, Urbana, line two. Hello.
Yes. You've touched close to this subject, but there's a tremendous pressure now to raise retirement age.
Ah.
And I am greatly in favor of letting people work into their 80s and 90s if they're capable and want to.
Right.
But there are no jobs.
Right. I touched on this, and I'm glad you bring this up because I want to expand on it. I have, like you, like the caller, I have no desire to retire. As long as I have my mind and as long as my readers don't retire me, which could always happen, as long as I have my mind, I intend to write for a living as long as I possibly can. But think about just a modest proposal to raise the retirement age to 70. What could be more reasonable? Well, it is reasonable for somebody like me. I haven't spent a lifetime of physical labor. But how reasonable is it for people whom the work they've done has left them unable to work, even if there were jobs, 8 hours a day beyond a certain age? And I'm not talking just about the obvious, coal miners and people who clean toilets in hotels for a living. But think about people who have stood on their feet behind a retail counter their entire lives for a living. I see them in my neighborhood in New York, women my own age, most of them African-American and Hispanic, working as checkout clerks in supermarkets. I see them when I come home. I'm buying food on the way home. I work in a nice special room for writers at the New York Public Library. Well, how able are they to stand on their feet all day? I sit in a nice ergonomically designed chair all day and look at a computer. There are no ergonomically designed chairs for those checkout clerks who are my own age. There are people who need to retire before they're 70. There are people who don't want to retire, and there are no jobs for them. We're just talking about just blithely as though raising the retirement age can solve the problem in a one-size-fits-all way. It's just not right.
There's another point I'd like to bring up. It does seem to me that the economy may be incapable of producing enough jobs, even for the prime age workers, and the government may have to step in and create jobs. We have a crying need for nurses who go out and assist people who are capable of living on their own, but not completely on their own.
Right.
We need daycare for children. This will never be something that private enterprise can do successfully because there isn't enough profit in it. And when you start taking shortcuts, you endanger the next generation.
Well, look, I don't want to get off on a political rant, but what you're talking about makes sense. But in the political climate right now, we're not hearing anything about it. And I think to return to my basic point, I think apart from the general hysteria about budget cutting and so on, that the 90 is the new 50 myth really discourages having any discussion about it. Because if we're assuming that everybody's going to be able to take care of themselves, then we don't have to think about it. And, you know, Americans, if anything has shown anything in the last few years, decades, it's that Americans are not very good at long-term thinking. And when you think about this huge problem of the baby boomers entering the old in 20 years is no time at all. Right now we're not thinking about anything like that. We're just thinking about how to keep the government open for the next 2 weeks.
We're at the point where we're going to have to stop. I have about a minute or so left.
Right.
I know that people have said that this is a negative book and that you have said, well, what you think is it's a realistic book. Is it possible to find any positive note one can end on?
Yes. it's only by facing the truth that we can make things better. People have actually said to me, what's wrong with a person believing that 90 is the new 50? It's no worse than a child believing in Santa Claus. I reply that to this, adults are not children. And if adults don't face reality, there is going to be no Santa Claus to bring us the gifts.
Well, I think at that, we're going to have to finish up. For people who want to read more on the subject, the book that we have been talking about is Never Say Die, The Myth and Marketing of the New Old Age. Pantheon is the publisher, by our guest, Susan Jacoby. She's also the author of a number of other books, most recently The Age of American Unreason. And Ms. Jacoby, thank you very much.
Thank you. And you can read an excerpt at susanjacoby.com.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.